I was just moving home, getting a job with my dad and my uncle, and I actually read the email. I was sleeping on my mom and dad's couch. I read the email, and I'm like, they just bought eight or nine episodes of my show. I've only filmed the pilot. That's all I've filmed. That's all I really know what I'm doing. Now what? Like, the dream just came true. I have it in the email. The dream just came true, and I don't know how to put it all together. No clue how to put it all together. Very nervous because they're wanting to get things moving, and they want to get production companies. They want to get people all, like, we're going to start filming soon. And I'm like, oh, I probably can't say it, but I said, oh, what do I do? And I went back to sleep for a couple minutes, and then I walked upstairs and tried to really unfold it all. So it was, reality hit me in the face.
From the wide open fields of South Dakota to the bright lights of national television, Benny Spies has carved a path unlike any other in the outdoor world. For over a decade, he chased the dream of telling hunting stories his way, raw, real, and relatable. With his beat-up 73 Winnebago, the Toaster, and a relentless passion for the outdoors, Benny became the voice of the every outdoorsman, proving that hunting isn't just about trophies, it's about laughter, mistakes, memories, and family traditions. Today, he joins us to talk about his journey from working behind the scenes at NBC and VH1 to hosting Gun It with Benny Spies to his proud partnership with Winchester. This is a conversation about persistence, passion, and the power of keeping it real. This is the Winchester Life Podcast, and I'm your host, Jason Brown. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. Through insider access to industry pioneers, firsthand looks at cutting-edge tech advancements, and the stories behind the scenes that have shaped the world of shooting sports and hunting as we know it, we'll dive into the sacred places like deer camps and duck blinds, talk about innovation and shooting tips with the world's best, while revisiting age-old traditions of hunting and shooting still alive in our country. I'm your host, Jason Brown, and welcome to the show. The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics.
Oh my goodness, I'm nervous.
Benny Spies, what's up, man? I'm glad you're finally on the show, and welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast, man.
Thank you for having me, and I'm super excited to be here. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been with Winchester since, we were just chatting, since 09. So, I mean, dang near two decades, yep. Decade and a half anyway.
Yep. Enough time for, my hair was brown when I started, and now it's gray, so it's been a few years. 2009, my show kicked off. We started filming in 2009, Gun with Benny Spies, and we premiered in 2010 on Versus, but in 2009, Jason Gilbertson over at Winchester Ammunition brought me on board and supplied us with all the ammo we could use on the show, and they were the very first with us, so it's pretty special. And I'm pretty excited and proud to still be part of the family, which is truly amazing, and I'm very thankful.
Hell yeah, it is. We'll dive into some of that later. I mean, it doesn't get better than Winchester. And when you say family, it is truly a family when you're part of it. And they make you feel that way. So let's reel everything back. Let's go to the beginning. Where'd you grow up? And do you remember kind of like your first outdoor experiences?
Do I remember growing up? Hardly. Man, I turned 50 this year. I'm going to turn 50.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, just life flies by. I grew up in South Dakota. I still live in South Dakota, but I grew up on the eastern part of the state, which is Watertown, South Dakota. But my dad and my grandpa took us out hunting from the moment I could, they could duct tape boots on me. And we hunted pheasants, ducks, nonstop, all season in South Dakota. Then slipped in some deer in there every once in a while. My dad would draw a tag, but I've been going strong since the early 80s, which again, I'm aging myself. I'm not really liking that, but been going strong for a lot of years. And I hope to do the same with my kids.
Well, I mean, you are. I see you're doing that with your kids.
Yeah, but I got a 4-year-old too. Yeah. He's still into Transformers and monster trucks and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So I'm trying to work him into this world.
And your daughter's older, right? Is she a teenager? She's 15, yeah, 16?
Senior year.
Okay. Senior year this year. Okay. Yeah. And I see her all over, you know, your Facebook page, and, you know, she shot big muleys and lots of pheasants. And you've done it right. Yep. You've done it right.
She has an incredible year ahead of her here in the great state of South Dakota. She's drawn she's drawn a couple premier deer tags in the state, and then she's drawn an elk tag in the state, and she's also has an antelope tag in the state of South Dakota. So
wow,
this year could be an epic year for an 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Epic,
man. It's going to be fun. Are you going to be along with her on the hunts, or how are you going to do that?
If she'll take me, I will be. I'll be along. Yeah, we got it. We're getting it figured out, but yeah.
That's cool.
We'll do it together. We've been hunting together for a lot of years.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't understand what South Dakota has, man. Like, it is epic hunting, and it's got some of the best hunting in the country. And I know you probably don't like to tell a lot of people that, but man, it's unreal.
I'm trying to keep it a secret, but when you're partnered with the wonderful folks at Winchester, they don't want me to.
Yeah.
So I can't. But yeah, pheasant hunting around here is epic. Of course, we're famous for it. You know, it's nonstop and from October to the end of January, and it's a lot of fun. And you know, the duck, goose, you know, upland, you know, antelope, deer. I mean, if you're lucky enough to draw an elk tag, those are tough to draw in the hills, but I think that's just resident only. But yeah, this state's full. And it's those full. Those antelope right there,
yeah,
they came from over here. They came from that right there. That did not come from over here. We didn't get that.
So what's your daughter's name?
Presley.
Presley. What's Presley's setup going to be for her mule deer this year?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I kind of came prepared for that. She's been shooting a featherweight 243, model 70 243 since that's what I first put her in years ago.
Yeah.
But since this year she lucked out and drew that elk tag, I'm thinking about bumping her up. And this is actually, I brought some examples.
Oh, sure.
This is what I think we're going to be doing right here. Ready for it? Here it comes.
Boom. Oh wow!
Right there, the 300 short mag. Yeah,
that is my favorite.
180 grain. So I haven't told her yet that it might buck. I'll let her find that on her own. But so we're gonna go with this.
Yeah.
Definitely for the elk, but you know, I think the deer as well. Maybe not the antelope, but that's our plan. I mean, obviously the 300 short mag's it's nasty.
It's a hammer.
Knockdown power is crazy. So, yeah.
Yeah, yep. It's I have a model 70, and it's my favorite gun for whitetail, just for everything. It's a hammer, man.
I'm doing something special for her this year. I got a super grade for her, so.
Ooh.
So this is her senior year. She can be spoiled a little bit. So we have a model 70 super grade. We're going to 300 short mag. So hopefully she can seal the deal.
Yeah.
No pressure.
She's a pretty good shot, right? I mean, she's been doing it since she's been little.
Because I'm on the podcast, I'm going to say yes. She's a pretty good shot, so she's great. She's great. She gets the little buck fever going a little bit, as we all do.
Yeah, everyone
does. I did back when I was, you know, a young buck when I was in high school or whatever. Yeah, I got buck. I still get buck fever. I'm not going to lie to you. I kind of showed you some of the deer around here earlier, and you know, one of these guys come walking by, I'm let it rip. You know,
let it rip.
It is what it is, but. Yeah, she's good at what she does. If she takes her time, that's it. She takes her time, we're good. But I'm a good dad sitting behind her.
All right, don't get too worked up.
I get more worked up than she does, actually.
After the shot, though.
Yeah,
So, all right. So, college. You graduate high school. You go into college. Yeah. South Dakota State first, then Florida State. Communications and media. What is it that sparked your interest in that?
Great question. Yeah, luckily graduated with a 2.0, probably a 1 GPA, which really rocked it in that Watertown High School. I went out to South Dakota State, and, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do ever in college. I just was there to drink beer, actually, and kind of, you know, have fun. And I can't even lie when I say that. If any of my friends or anybody that I know watches this, they'll say, like, no, Ben, you didn't do anything in college but drink beer, which is true. But I actually figured it out. If I would study before the exams, I could do pretty good. But as I was going through college, I didn't know, I had any idea what I wanted to do. There was a general communication course or major at South Dakota State University. I was in my, I think, my junior year or whatever, and I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I walked in the communication department's office and asked them what this general communication degree meant, and they said it's for someone like a junior or senior who didn't know what they want to do in life. I said, sign me up. Yeah. I think that sounds good to me. If I can get a couple more of these classes under my belt, I can graduate and then go figure it out. But it didn't stop there, because I went on to Florida State for a graduate degree, and as I was still trying to navigate life and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. So from SDSU with a bachelor to Florida State with a master's degree, that was in marketing communication. And with that degree at Florida State, they offered us a few credits as an internship, and I chose or applied for, which I think you're going to talk about, is Conan O'Brien. So yeah, laid down with Conan O'Brien internship. So yeah, that was kind of the journey to get to there.
So at this point, you're in college. You went from South Dakota State to Florida State, like a giant change there. I mean, one in scenery of all kinds, but it's just completely different. Why Florida State?
Great question. During my junior year of my bachelor's, there's a national student exchange program that all these state universities are a part of. And so I chose to enroll in that with a couple buddies, and we got to choose three different schools. And between LSU, NC State, I think, and FSU, and FSU was our number one choice, we applied for it and we got it. And so my junior year of my bachelor's, we went down to Florida State. So I made some good friends down there and got in good with the communication department at Florida State. And Dr. Steve McNamara got me in to come down there for my master's degree. So yeah, I went back.
Yeah. So if you're like me, I mean, you were an outdoorsman growing up as part of your life. I went to Central Michigan and found production, found broadcasting, like my sophomore year. I didn't even know they had it. This is how dumb I was. I went and played baseball and then transferred to CMU to play baseball, but I found broadcasting, and it just hit me on the side of the head. Like, my whole life has been about the outdoors. I'm gonna make this production life part of what I'm doing. That was in the late 90s. So, I mean, the Outdoor Channel had just started, just barely. TNN Outdoors had existed. ESPN Outdoors had existed. So there wasn't a whole lot of media available. Like, it was pretty exclusive if you were doing anything in the outdoor production space at all. But the VHS industry, which turned into DVD, was, you know, my main driver growing up. I'd watch all the old VHS tapes and get all primed up before I went out for a hunt and all that stuff, all the greats. But man, it's like when it clicked in my head, I thought through everything that I was doing from a production standpoint, I imagined it in the outdoor industry. That's how I learned it. I learned it through the outdoor industry glasses, if you will. Did you do that when you were there? Did you think when you're at the time, I'm gonna position everything I learned, I'm gonna apply that to the outdoor space?
I take it back a couple steps. The winter time in South Dakota is pretty brutal. It can get pretty cold and the wind never stops blowing. So as a kid, I would sit in my basement and watch old Bay Winkleman, Buck McNeely, Bill Dance, Roland Martin, all the old school guys, and I would just study those shows. I just watch them over and over and over and over. And that's kind of, you know, what hooked. I mean, obviously I was very active in the outdoor space as much as I could do at that time, whatever age I was. But at the same time, watching those shows just kind of, you know, that's kind of where it hooked me. And From that point, it's kind of, you know, a weird transition to get to, or however I went through life to get through to the outdoor space. But it all started back with the Babe Winkleman days.
Yeah, it's weird, man. You don't realize the influence that that stuff had on you growing up. And then when you have an opportunity to make it a part of your life, it's like, holy shit, I'm going to do this. And, you know, I feel like that's what that is what happened with me. I kind of feel like that's potentially kind of what happened with you. But then you take this next step. You do an internship out in L.A., right?
New York.
Okay, with Conan. Conan's in New York. Yep. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Talk about that, man. Like a kid from South Dakota, you go into New York City, and now you're, you know, in behind the scenes at the Conan O'Brien show. Like, what was that like?
Pretty wild. I mean, you're right. Coming from South Dakota, go to Florida State for a couple of years, you know, that's definitely not New York City. And then just get dropped off in New York City and said, or told, you know, go figure it out. 30 Rock's where you're going to be working, sixth floor. And actually the ninth floor is where Conan's offices are. Sixth floors of the studio is. And just go figure it out. But, you know, but being an intern at there is pretty much what you think it is. It's fetching coffee and making, you know, copies for people and running around. But that's what was amazing for a guy like me. I was always into the late night programs as well. So at that time, not really much at this time, but the late night television, I was a big Letterman fan and, you know, liked watching all those programs. So to just get the opportunity to go in and see, you know, work around Conan. And that's the thing about Conan too, is you're working on that ninth floor and he's right there with you. Andy Richter was there too.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're right there with you. You know, there wasn't much separation there. So, which is an awesome experience.
Yeah. And sure. I think, you know, not getting too far ahead, we'll get into this a little deeper, but the way that you produced your show was with comedy. There was comedy always infused into your Gunnett series. Is that just who you are? Or is that kind of, did that come from a little bit of hanging out with Conan over those, you know, over that time?
Well, it wouldn't have been hanging out with Conan, but it would have been more, I'd say more reality. And then the comedy is just maybe who I am. But if you would have seen the early attempts at trying to make my show, we all would, it wasn't good. The early stuff that's, I think only one person maybe has ever seen. And if you remember Steve Gruber.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the
day. Absolutely. Michigan guy.
Steve helped me. Yep, he helped me back, way back, you know, kind of get things launched and figured out. But, the original stuff was bad.
Yeah, really the old Wolf Creek Productions days. Yeah,
Wolf Creek Productions. But that bad stuff is what kind of molded it into what it became.
Yeah.
Later. So I took it down to the bare worst it could be. And then figure like, okay, well, we don't want to do this. I got to do something different. What's that going to be? And then that was, you know, growing up watching outdoor television. And, you know, the shows were, you know, kind of all, you know, who can catch more, who can do more, who can climb the biggest mountain and do all these things. That was never me. I could never do that. I love the fact that, you know, try to get a TV show going and do things my way. And then the whole think about doing things my way, like, okay, well, I'm not that guy. Let's just do something different. And that's the different reality, different. And my personality, I guess, just made it what it was.
Yeah. And I think that is different. And I think honestly, that style, it still carries weight today. Like I think that show, if that ran today, would just be at, probably, honestly, I swear it'd be more popular now on YouTube than it was back then. I really do. I mean, I think it's, it was pretty genius to the way it was all set up. So go through the way you set that up. Was there a conscious effort into how you unfolded your storyline? Because a lot of it includes South Dakota living on the ranch, your buddies. Again, we'll get into the toaster, all these things. Was that all part of the plan, or did that happen naturally?
It became that. Like I said, the original stuff was more of a sketch type thing that I was trying to do, a desk type show, and make, not really sketch, because I'm not a sketch guy or a funny guy like that, but it was, but that's actually, to answer the Conan thing, that's where it's kind of came from that a little bit. And then that was so bad that I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go be me. But being me means, well, that means my buddies, because it's always my friends and I out going to have a good time, and kind of whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
And then that's like, well, I'm not the guy that, you know, has the biggest, baddest, you know, pickup out there. And I'm not the guy that has the, you know, climb that, like I said, to climb the highest mountain or shoot the biggest deer or the most ducks or everything. I'm just kind of the guy that goes out and just wants to have some fun and maybe drink a few beers when we're all done. And, you know, at that time, you know, we wanted, or I would wanted it, a, you know, more of a fun vehicle to put in the show. And I bought an old, International Scout.
Oh yeah.
That we started with. And that was actually too nice. It was a 1970 and it only had 37,000 miles on it.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I still have it. And so I'm like, God, I don't really want to wreck that thing. And then I was going to buy an El Camino because it's, why not?
That's, why not?
It's kind of funny, but we couldn't put a whole crew into that thing to haul around. So then that's when the toaster was sitting by McDonald's in Watertown, South Dakota. I drove by it and I'm like, that's it.
Got to have it.
I'm going to walk in this guy's shop and see if he'll sell it to me, which he didn't really want to, by the way. But I talked him into it.
You talked him into it. So it's a 73 Winnebago, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I had some buddies make this for me, and it's going to be hard to show you because it's so big, but look at this thing.
Oh, geez. Look at that. So for those of you who can't see this or listening on the podcast, this is actually an exact replica of what they deem the toaster. And what, you know, you call it a toaster because it looked like a toaster, right?
It looks like a toaster, but in one of the first episodes, a buddy of mine who owns a body shop in my hometown, we needed him to fix it up and do some modifications to it to try to make it roadworthy and in the field worthy. And so we shot that, might have been the first or second episode, and we shot that with him. And then I think he's the one who named it the toaster. So Ron Burchat's right there. I think I'm gonna give him the credit for it.
Give Ron the credit.
It looks like
like a toaster.
That thing became, you know, not that famous is the wrong word, but when I would do my appearances for Cabela's or the state of South Dakota or whatever, they would ask me to have the toaster on the site.
Yeah.
More people would want to go hang out in that thing than they really cared about, you know, coming to see me, which that means I did something right, I guess.
It was a character, man. It was a character.
We raced it. We had fun, you know. The very first episode, we had the refrigerator in there so full of beer, and I didn't have it latched. And the door, you know, obviously, when I was so nervous, you know. That's a pretty good story there too, how the show kind of came to be. But I was so nervous about being my first show, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I had the whole door filled up with Grain Belt beer. And when I turned the corner on my block, the door whipped open and all the beer spilled out and broke on the floor of the toaster. I'm like, well, all my camera guys are looking at me. I'm like, well, don't even clean it up. Just keep rolling. It is what it is, and this is what the show is going to be. So let's go.
Yeah.
And so
that's crazy.
That thing served its life out on the show, and right now it's sitting on my buddy's ranch, and we're gonna make it into a deer blind, I think.
Well, we're gonna be out filming some stuff with you here in a couple months, so I definitely cool. We talked about, we got to see that toaster again, so get her ripping.
Yes.
Stay tuned for part two of this week's conversation, but first, after the break, we'll dive into everything ammunition on our weekly Ammo 101 segment. This portion of the Winchester Life Podcast has been brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, a world leader in delivering innovative products. Winchester is the American legend, a brand built on integrity, hard work, and a deep focus on its loyal customers. Considered one of the world's leading ammunition manufacturers, Winchester has built its reputation on delivering innovative ammunition products, providing top-shelf customer service, and demonstrating industry leadership. To learn more, visit winchester.com. Winchester Optics. The Winchester Supreme line of optics offers rifle scopes, binoculars, spotting scopes, and rangefinders for all of your shooting and hunting needs. To learn more, visit worldofwinchester.com. Winchester Repeating Arms. the guns that work with a reputation built on reliability. Winchester rifles and shotguns are built tough with superior fit and finish. Winchester firearms are built to exceed expectations. To learn more, visit WinchesterRepeatingArms.com. All right, Ammo 101 this week. We've got Kyle Massanelli in here from Winchester Ammunition. And the good part is usually this, you know, this segment is remote, but we have you and Ben.
That's right.
And we'll be going through some different ammunition products from Winchester this week. So first up on the docket, double shot. Yeah. Last call double shot. Let's talk about that and kind of the thought process behind that when you guys kind of created that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, near and dear topic to me, right? Waterfowl hunting. We all love it. It's starting to get a little cool outside. We're all pretty excited about it. But, you know, last call double shot really is just a new product. We just announced it here this summer, ready for the 2025 hunting seasons. You know, it's a follow-on to our introduction last year in 2024, which was last call.
Yeah.
Right? 100% tungsten payloads in that last call. Fantastic product, right? Major increases in pellet counts with that tungsten shot in there. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty obvious, and we knew when we developed that product and introduced it last year, that was going to be at a price point that wasn't quite reachable for every consumer, or maybe they just didn't want to reach it.
Yeah, right? Sure.
I mean, you start talking $4 or $5 plus a shot for full up last
call
tungsten.
Yeah, that's a significant increase.
That's expensive to go waterfowl hunting with, right? Where you're shooting 2-3 shells every time a volley of birds come in. So that's where last call double shot came in, which is, okay, how do we get the benefits of tungsten into more consumers' hands and more hunters' hands?
Yeah. So I think the important thing to think about too is explain the shot when it's actually in the shell. How's it? What do you have in there that makes it significant? Why is it called double shot?
Yeah, so it's double shot because it is a stacked payload of two different shot types and shot sizes.
Yeah.
Right. So the way we can bring that price point down is it can't be 100% tungsten like last call. So what we did is we blended it with premium steel shot.
Okay.
Right? Steel shot, kind of the gold standard for waterfowl hunting, right? Ever since non-toxic regulations were required in the early 90s. And what we were able to do with that is blend premium steel and tungsten shot together. Now, I said blend, but it's really not a blend. It's actually a stacked payload.
Yeah.
Right? So we're taking steel shot. And new this year with last call double shot is we've got new shot sizes. We've actually got half shot sizes.
Okay.
And everybody says, well, why'd you do half shot sizes? Well, we've also identified that there's always that constant battle of the waterfowl hunter. And anybody that's sat in a blind long enough, everybody's talked about, well, I shoot twos or I shoot threes or I shoot fours at ducks. Well, we found out that 2.5s for large size ducks was kind of that perfect blend of, you know, keep the pellet counts a little bit higher than twos, those bigger shot sizes, but yet had enough penetration. And then we said, well, how much tungsten can we layer in there to ultimately get that pellet count up at least 30%? That was kind of like the target. That was the threshold. Let's get pellet counts up 30% above what a straight steel load would be. Okay. Yeah. And the reason we do that, and I should probably explain that in a little more detail, is because tungsten is so dense, you can use a substantially smaller shot size. And whenever you have smaller shot in a given space of a shell, you get more pellets.
Right? Yeah. So tungsten is over 2 times heavier than lead, right?
Correct. Yeah. It's not quite 2 times heavier than lead. It's more than 2 times heavier than steel.
Gotcha.
Okay. So if you think about densities, and we can nerd out for a second here, you know, steel's down just under about 8 grams per cc.
Yep.
Lead's just under 12.
Yep.
Right? Tungsten's all the way up 18.
Okay.
Right? So you're more than double higher density than steel, but not quite double lead.
Sure. So when you talk about TSS, the process of manufacturing is different. I don't know, it was a couple of years ago, I was at the Shot Tower in East Alton, and just kind of saw how steel shot was made. It's completely different for TSS. Explain a little bit about the TSS shot sizes, how it's created, how it's made.
Yeah, so you saw lead shot being made at
the
Shot Tower, and that's where you can take molten lead and drop it through the air basically to make nice round pellets. Works great for a nice, soft, malleable material like lead.
Right.
tungsten, you know, that's not applicable, right? Yeah. We wish it could make it that way, but it can't, right? The melting point is so high of tungsten that actually this tungsten shot actually starts life as tungsten powder.
Okay.
You know, just fine granular powder that ultimately has to be pressure cast into the shape of a pellet.
Got it. So this season, I'm going to put you in a situation. You have a hunt down in Arkansas. It's flooded timber. It's a hunt you've wanted to go on for a long time. As a consumer, there is a point where it is good to invest. Mm-hmm. Your backyard birds, maybe you're shooting steel. Maybe it's expert. Maybe it's something. Maybe it's final pass. Maybe something different. But explain why, in my opinion, it's a good investment to put in to spend the money on the TSS.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to hit probability, right? Yeah. I mean, I always explain to people, well, the only connection you have between you as the hunter and the bird is the payload you're getting
right
to the quarry, right?
Yeah.
That's the only connection you have. Well, the only way you're successfully harvesting that quarry is put pellets on target.
That's right.
Well, how do you improve your probability of putting pellets on target besides practicing and shooting a lot, right? That's always rule number one, you know, become competent with your shotgun. But beyond that, you can improve that probability by just getting more pellets on target.
For sure.
And that's where a product like Last Call Double Shot comes in, because you know, you're taking those payloads up by 30%, right?
Yep.
I don't know about you, but 30% more pellets I'll take all day long.
Oh, right? For sure.
Right? And that's where that investment into, okay, these higher density, you know, larger quantity pellets, yep, right? More of them, you know, in the case of this duck load, right? We talked about 2.5 steel with a stack load of number 9 tungsten on top, right?
Yeah.
So that takes that pellet count from, let's say we were just talking about straight number 2 load, it'd be 155 or so pellets in that.
Yeah.
Well, now you're carrying about 210 pellets.
Sure.
That's a substantial increase.
Substantial, yeah.
Okay, now you're down there and you got trophy mallards or that, you know, fantastic pintail with about a 9-inch sprig on the back of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, I want more pellets flying.
You want there. More pellets flying. Yeah, it's worth it. We went to Kodiak Island last year, and we were able to test double shot out there. And the first Harlequins that came in, they were about 65 yards ripping across the bottom of the water and, dumped them, just rolled them. And, you know, I think that's the benefit. When you're investing into the trip, into the time out there, there really is a benefit to having a more expensive, better performing shot shell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the price point does come with performance, right? It's not just about a better looking box or a better looking shell. There's truly technology you're paying for.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, thanks. Appreciate the rundown on Last Call Double Shot.
Man, anytime. I appreciate talking about waterfowl.
Coming up next on the Winchester Life podcast is part 2 of our guest conversation. But first, a few words from our partners. Nylo, the prestigious Winchester hunting and shooting sports facility, is now an Orvis-endorsed hunting grounds. Over the course of more than 160 years, Orvis has built a brand synonymous with quality, integrity, and the finest service standards in the industry. This recognition ensures that visitors of an Orvis-endorsed operation encounter unparalleled service, respect for natural resources, and an experienced professional staff. Located in Brighton, Illinois, Nylo was founded by John M. Olin in 1952 as an ideal model of conservation. Nylo is dedicated to unsurpassed upland hunting, sport shooting, and some of the finest hunting dogs in the country. Over time, Nylo has filled its guest books with distinguished names and hosted shooting sports competitions and events benefiting various national and local charities. For more information and to book your shooting sports or hunting experience, visit nylofarms.com. And now, back to the show.
So, in the beginning, talk about getting that show off the ground. I know there's a story to it. What was the story? And it's not easy. I mean, you got to get sponsors. You got to get all this stuff. You got to pay for everything. Were you on Versus to start?
Yep. Yeah, okay. I spent three seasons on Versus. And actually, when I first – so I did the internships at Conan O'Brien. I actually did two of them. Then I went to work at MTV and VH1 for a few years in New York City. I left the city. I was there from 99 to about 2004, I think.
Yeah.
And when I left New York City, I came back home. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to try this. And I'm going to see if I can put all my ideas and my – all these – for years and years and years in notebooks and on bar napkins, I would write down my ideas. Maybe 2% of them made sense, but I kept them all. And I'm like, I'm at all these ideas for all these years. I'm going to go home and see if I can make it all make sense and put it all together and make a TV show out of this thing. And I hired a local guy, Troy Bolzer, give him this man credit. He definitely did a wonderful job for me in trying to get this vision off the ground. If that makes any sense, vision off the ground.
Yeah, sure.
And we set out with a camera, an old Grand Wagoneer, and I started filming a TV show. At that time, it was named Shooting Blanks with Benny. And I'll tell you that they Versus maybe changed that for obvious reasons. We made a pilot 50
soon, so maybe that's going to be come back and you can use that. Yeah. You can use that.
Oh, it's full circle. Yeah. But so I was, you know, we just went out to try to film the show, and we made a pilot, and then, you know, Gruber helped me put that pilot together, and kind of, you know, get it figured out, and then I had a guy in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, edit it together for me, and then we went and bought some airspace on KDLT in Sioux Falls, the NBC affiliate, and we put it on after SNL on a Saturday night. I think it was right before the Star Spangled Banner went off. Yeah. And we aired it like two or three weekends in a row to try to, and we put a little website out there for people to give us feedback, and it worked pretty good. We got a lot of good feedback, and at that point it was like, okay, well, we did that. How much further can we take it? And I actually sent it off to like Omaha and Minneapolis and the Fox affiliates or the NBC affiliates there, and nobody would touch it. If you saw it, you'd know why, but nobody would touch it. And in my office, I have an old post-it note on yellow post-it note where I think it was out of Omaha. The guy that I sent it to sent it back to me with the DVD with the post-it note. It just says, "Nope, Mike."
Mike didn't like it.
Whoever, Mike. Yeah, thanks, Mike. I framed it. I framed that too, and I sent it to Outdoor Channel, trying to get them to buy it. Yeah. And I have that Mitch Petrie was here the other day. And he saw that letter.
Was that from Wade Sherman back then, maybe, huh?
I think it was Wade Sherman, yeah. It was the old thanks but no thanks letter. I framed that too. So I sent it all out, you know, trying to get sold and get my idea out there. And it was a little ahead of the time.
It was.
It was a reality show, just going out and trying to have some fun. And it wasn't about climbing the biggest mountains. It wasn't about shooting the biggest deer. And it actually was more about reality. We showed the misses. We showed the hits. We showed the good times, we showed the bad times, but we made sure to always have a good time, and it ended up working because of a guy named Jeff Macaluso at Versus. He's the one that ended up bringing it on board, and that guy, Jeff, made my dream come true. So that was a wonderful day when I got that email.
I remember that guy. So Macaluso greenlights it. Now what?
Yep. I was just moving home, getting a job with my dad and my uncle. And I actually read the email. I was sleeping on my mom and dad's couch. I read the email. And I'm like, they just bought eight or nine episodes of my show. I've only filmed the pilot. That's all I've filmed. That's all I really know what I'm doing. Now what? Like the dream just came true. I have it in the email. The dream just came true. And I don't know how to put it all together. No clue how to put it all together.
Yeah.
Very nervous because they're wanting to get things moving. And they want to get production companies. They want to get people all, it's like, we're going to start filming soon. And I'm like, I probably can't say it, but I said, what do I do? And I went back to sleep for a couple minutes. And then I walked upstairs and tried to really unfold it all.
Yeah. So,
reality hit me in the face.
Yeah, and Versus was a little different than Outdoor Channel, Sportsman Channel. Like, they actually paid money for the episodes, which you know, we have our drop series is a is an original series. So some of those original television series are funded by the network, but that was Versus was a little bigger. I mean, Versus was back then. It had more people, bigger audience than Outdoor Channel. In Sportsman Channel, I don't even think existed, or maybe just started to come into the fray about then. So once you laid it out all on paper and kind of got your thoughts together, what was the next step? You had to find a shoot camera operator. You had to get your hunt schedule together. You had to do all this stuff.
Well, Versus became very active in the show, so they bought the show.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was scrambling to figure out who the production company was going to be, and a lot of names, a lot of people were being floated out there, and I didn't know anybody, and we signed a deal with Half Yard Productions out of Bethesda, Maryland, Sean Gallagher and Abby, and a guy named Matt Chenet and Andy Schwartz and Greg Smith. These guys all came on board to really put this thing together.
Yep.
And they are why Gunnit became Gunnit. I had a lot of ideas written down on napkins. I had a lot of ideas written down in notebooks, a lot of ideas still up in my brain or parked in my head. And those guys made it, okay, Ben, we're going to go duck hunting, but we're going to, you know, open another show this way. Then we're going to race the toaster, or we're going to do whatever it is. They could put the story together. And I wasn't good at that. And they were amazing at it. Actually, they were the best at it.
Yeah.
And between my dumb ideas and their TV genius, they made it happen.
Yeah,
so a Half Yard Production. Yeah.
You gotta have that group that just kind of, you know, you kind of jive. And I'm sure at the beginning it was kind of figuring each other out. But once you guys, I mean, the creative came out of your brain, right? And you just kind of said, this is what I want to do. And they figured out how to create the storyline for the episode.
They put the pieces together, but you can tell in that first season, it's still a lot for me. It's not easy for me. I was searching pretty hard of, okay, how am I going to do this? And I was, you know, kind of a perfectionist, and a show like this can't be perfect because that's what it's not.
Yeah.
And it was little inner battles within myself, I guess. But we had the right people at the right time to make the show what it became.
Yeah. So I mean, you had 7 seasons, right? In total.
Yep.
What was, if you think back, what was your favorite experience, whether it was a hunt or a place you went, out of all of them? I'm sure, you know, there's 70, 80, 90 of them, episodes, original episodes or more. What is the one hunt that kind of stands out of the one story?
That's out of the, whatever, yeah, 7 seasons, and I don't even know how many episodes that is. That's a lot of them stick out. I mean, if you look around in here, you know, there's like a lot of these mounts, like that antelope right there was shot on the show. And, you know, there's a lot of great experiences right here, but it was mostly who I was with and hanging with my friends and filming the show. You know, we went out and we're filmed an ice fishing segment up in Akaska, South Dakota. We had the toaster out on the ice. We're out there doing on the ice, and we're fishing, cooking burgers out there, drinking beer after we did this, and just having a good time out there, playing golf out there. We're just having a great time out there, catching a few fish here and there. Actually, it probably would have been one of the best probably segments we could have put in the show out of the 7 years. We lost that footage somehow, some way. That's when we went from tapes to the little cards.
Yeah.
And we were sitting around the hotel like, oh, now what do we do? And my cameraman, Andy Schwartz, said, let's do like an Olympics. Let's do an Olympics. And that's when the Toaster Olympics, how that became. So I have amazing hunts, but it's mainly who I was with.
Yeah.
You know, that made the show what it was, because it was never me carrying the show. It was more my buddies that could really hit it home for me.
Yeah, man. And that's what it's all about. I mean, I think your production team is your family, and, you know, you think about all these places you've been over the years, and, you know, we're going on, you know, 9 seasons of drop now, and you think about all the crazy things that we've had to do out in the middle of Alaska or wherever we are. But it's really what sticks with you is those moments that you have with the crew, with your buddies.
Yep.
And it's not the giant moose or, you know, the giant grizz or whatever that is, man. It is those moments. And I think that's in hunting in general, it's deer camp. It's not what you shoot at deer camp. It's deer camp that's important.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I think that's the same way with production.
I'm still wondering if I'm going to get that invite for another drop.
Hey, man.
I mean, wouldn't you want to spend 30 days or however many days out there with me?
Yeah, we're going in 3 weeks, man. You got some time? Yeah. I do want to talk about your Harlequin and Goldeneye hunt. That was kind of, that was a bucket lister, right?
Very much.
Yeah, talk about that hunt and how that unfolded and the whole story there.
At that time of the show, you know, we were trying to branch out a little bit from South Dakota because most of the shows were filmed here in the state. And so I was looking for things like, okay, bucket list stuff, like you just said. Like, what is the one thing that I can afford to do? You know, not a bucket list, you know, desert bighorn sheep, but a bucket list, maybe duck or whatever. Harlequin popped up. And then it was like, okay, wow, maybe we can do this thing. Started making some phone calls, trying to figure it out. What season was that? Six, maybe?
Probably. It's towards the end, I think.
Towards the end.
Yeah.
And that time, I don't think you can shoot Harlequin in Washington anymore in the Puget Sound. I don't think you can do that now.
Yeah.
That was right towards the end of that. And got the phone call all made and got it all scheduled and got over there and just started. Well, actually, my cameraman came out with the flu. So that was another little obstacle we had trying to figure out how to film a hunting show without a cameraman. We navigated through that and you could shoot one Harlequin.
Yeah.
One. And we set up for Harlequin one day and they didn't work anything. And then the Goldeneye thing happened, the Barrels Goldeneye, which was a bucket list for me, happened. Scoters happened, and which was amazing. And at that point, I could tell everybody was having a hard time. Like, oh, shoot, what are we going to do to try to get this Harlequin thing figured out? And when you have two camera guys, you know, you got maybe two or three camera guys sitting there. And then you have a couple good old boys guiding me. You know, we have a lot of people sitting in these boats trying to make a duck hunt happen. And as you know, the more people, the harder it is. The more equipment, the more boats, the more things, the harder it is. And we tried a new spot. And then that final day, and we had one come flying through. And it was the lead up to that saying, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have one shot at this thing. If I miss this thing, here we go. But, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
I didn't miss him. So it ended up making it happen. But that was we went out of Washington for that hunt.
Okay, and,
that was pretty epic and pretty special to be able to do that.
Do you so that would have probably been in 15 or 16 or something like that.
14 or 15 probably.
Do you remember your setup, your gun and ammo setup at the time for that?
SX3, been shooting my SX3. They did let me bring the shotgun. Yep, that was an SX3 I was shooting, and I wouldn't remember my the ammo I'd have been shooting back then. But my go to is a Super X.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm a 3-inch deuce guy. So that's. Yep. It's probably a 98% chance that's what I was shooting.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, have you been out, have you no Harlequin since? Is that your only one? Only Harley?
One, yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, I'm batting 1,000 on it right now. And
You
know, the whole thing when you have a 4-year-old, you have a 7-year-old, you have a 17-year-old, slows things down a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
So I haven't made her back out. But I'm slowly and I'm trying to convince my wife that I need to go branch back out and maybe do the King Eider thing. That's my biggest bucket list right there, the King Eider, right? Which is probably everybody's on the planet.
But for sure.
If I could do that, then whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Let's drop and do that.
Let's go.
Let's do that.
Let's go to Iceland.
Well, sure. I just renewed my passport. I'm ready.
You could. I just did too.
That would be great.
That would be great. Actually, we're talking about doing one in February here coming up. So
I'll supply the ammo. I'll supply the gear.
Yeah.
I'll supply everything if we could take Benny on that trip because
call Gilbertson. Call Gilbertson.
He blocked me.
That's funny. So, okay, so kids, that's kind of a natural transition into after seven seasons, it's just like, I'm shutting her down and moving on. What was the final, straw? You're just like, I got a transition and my life change. What was it?
Be honest with you, the show was still, this is the hard part. You work so hard to achieve your dream, right? I mean, it is, that was 100%, man. I gave 1,000% to make it happen. It was 100%, you know, all my friends and networking to get it done, but it wasn't easy. And so you worked so hard in all those years to achieve that dream, and then all of a sudden it's like, I don't know if I'm having fun anymore.
Yeah.
And my cameraman, Andy, said at season four, he goes, Ben, as soon as you're not having fun anymore, it's time to step out.
Yep.
And that was around season four. It was kind of some things were changing and, you know, hung on for three more seasons. But it was kind of the business side.
Sure.
I had the best partners on the planet, the best partners on the planet. And I had just signed quite a few new deals, 2-year deals or 3-year deals or whatever. I just signed, re-upped a lot of them. And, but the years of most everything on my shoulders between handling the production and handling the editing and then handling the pretty much A to Z on everything just kind of wore me down.
Yeah, man.
Just wore me down.
It wasn't
the same. And I wanted to continue to have fun, but I didn't know if I was having fun anymore. So it was kind of time. But at the same time, out of being honest, my dad was retiring at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad threw out there is like, man, if you want to change, you know, jobs and do something different, Nick, you better make a decision soon. So
that did
have something to do with it as well. But I was getting tired on the TV side.
Well, looking back, I mean, it's been 8-9 years since then. Is there a time you think back and you're like, man, maybe I should have hung on, or maybe I want to do something again, or were you just like, I'm done with it?
I made the right decision.
Yeah.
I don't regret much. I love the TV. I love doing the TV, but you know, at that time, you know, the YouTube world was really taken off, and all that other media was really taken off, and that wasn't enough time in the day for me to try to accomplish all that.
Yep.
And that was wearing on me. Like, I wanted to give Winchester or Cabela's or, you know, State of South Dakota, or I can, you know, start going through my laundry list of I was spoiled by my partners, very, very lucky. I wanted to give them 110% all day, every day.
Yep.
All day, every day, because you know what? They deserve it.
Yeah.
And the moment, you know, I didn't know if I could do it because of everything, and that's just was really, really wore on me.
Yeah. No, I get it, man. It's tough, and that's kind of a good. That time was a weird transition in outdoor media.
Yeah.
And everything went very digital. Social media exploded. So, you know, the demands for a production company or a show for you know, assets in deliverables, it was nonstop. I mean, it is just nonstop post. So, it can be a lot, man. It can be a lot. You'd mentioned your dad this last March, this year. He completed his sheep slam.
Yes.
Talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, he did. 78 years old. His sheep hunting career started back in the 70s in Alaska. And I just remember as a young kid, you know, I didn't really know how it all worked or anything. But when he'd come back from one of those trips, I was like, damn, Where were you? What did you do? I mean, holy cow, look at these. Everything's on slides. You know, there was no really pictures back then and all that stuff. Looking at slideshows of all these hunts he was going on. And he went on quite a few doll sheep hunts in Alaska. And that was in the 70s. And then he got a stone sheep in the 90s. And actually, I was on a trip with him on that. We only got one ram. The weather was pretty crappy on that deal. And then he drew his South Dakota bighorn sheep tag. Yeah. So he won that one.
Yeah.
And he won another doll sheep. My dad's pretty lucky.
Yeah.
So he won a couple sheep hunts. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, he got another phone call. And he won a desert bighorn sheep hunt in Mexico, which would be completing his Grand Slam. So we had about 2 years lead up time to that. My dad's 78 years old. He'll be 79 next week.
Man.
Wow. And at 78 years old, we set out, or him at 70 years old, set out to accomplish his Grand Slam in February in Mexico. And it was awesome. I don't know how much more you want to ask.
But talk about the hunt. I want to know about the hunt, the whole setup.
Yeah. So, you know, we get into camp, and it was, you know, a beautiful place, and one of the RT family down there, A plus everything down in Sonora. And, we get into camp and get all set up and try to get, these guys own mountains, and on these mountains are these sheep, and we got to try to figure out how to get my dad 78 up and down these mountains. And, day number one, we go out glassing and looking for sheep, and we see sheep, but they're too far away to kind of try to get anything going. Day number two, we go out after them and try to get close. We do see some rams, but we couldn't get quite get close enough for my dad to get a comfortable shot. He's not really used to the times nowadays where people are shooting 400 or 500 yards.
Yeah,
which I'm not that guy either. But he wants something in there, 200, 250, 300 max. You know, he wants that, and we couldn't close the door on that deal. Couldn't get close enough.
Yeah.
Day number three didn't work out either. We're seeing a lot of rams, but we're not able to make anything happen. And on day number four, my brother was there as well. My brother Josh, and I was with my dad, kind of on one side of the mountain range. And my brother's on the other side of mountain range, and we ended up meeting up with them, and they said we found one. It's about 900 yards away, and hopefully we can get a shot at him. And so at that point, we put the plan together and started going up the hill. My dad went up there very slow, which he should, 78 years old. It wasn't easy, and got up on the side of the mountain, and the guy Jacob RT, the guide, looks at me. He goes, "It's or George, his bro, one of the two, said it's going to be about 326 yards." And I'm like, "Oh my goodness!" I look at my dad, and I said, "Dad, you don't have to shoot if you don't want to. If you're not comfortable, you don't have to shoot." And this is day number four. This is his third mountain. I don't think he has a fourth mountain in him. And I'm like, I look back at Jacob or George, and I say, "Get him comfortable, make him shoot, but get him comfortable."
Yeah.
And he got comfortable, and he shot. I'm not going to tell you how it all went down, but he connected, and we got the ram, and the Grand Slam was a done deal. And
that's awesome.
Seeing him after that, he needed to take a minute just to kind of take it all in, which I would too, man. I mean, that's such a huge deal, and it was pretty special, very special that my brother and I were there with him.
Oh, for sure, man.
Be a part.
Yeah, and there's something about seeing a dad, and a lot of dads are, I don't know about your dad, but a lot of dads are in your mind as a son, they're kind of stoic. So to see, oh, there's the picture right there. Yeah, that's cool. You and your brother. And
this is the picture like right after he shot it.
Yeah.
He was, that might be tough to see.
No, I can see it. Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Right after, he was pretty exhausted, which I would be too. But when that ram went down, I'm like, whoa, we got her done. And at that point, I could see all the weight off his shoulders. And he was,
You'll never forget it, man. That's what it's all about, man. That's what hunting with your family. I mean, just you guys will have that very, very special memory forever. And you can't replace that, man.
That's probably top of the list.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. So that was exciting.
That's awesome. So this year, are you, do you have any hunts planned? I know your daughter's got a bunch, but do you have any?
Yeah, we have following her around.
Yeah.
Yeah, this year, actually, you know, I got lucky this year. I drew a mountain goat tag in Montana. So I got pretty lucky on that. Here, I think it opens up maybe next week, but I don't go next week. I go in a few weeks. But so I have a mountain goat tag in Montana that I'm going to go attempt, which, you know, I live here about 1,500 feet elevation. Yeah, about 1,500 feet. And these goats are a lot higher, so we'll see if the old ticker can get me up there.
Yeah.
And so I have that, which I'm very, very excited about.
That's
and then
awesome.
I do have a couple deer tags here in South Dakota, which when I get to hunt with my buddy TJ, that's, you know, that's about the most fun time on the planet. And then I got a West River tag too. So
it's right gonna,
we have an awesome year ahead of us.
That's so great, man. So what's your, what's your gun and ammo setup for mountain goat?
6.8 Western. I'm going 6.8 Western, 165 grain bullet. That's 100%. That's what I'm going with.
Yeah.
I've shot a lot of deer with that, shot my elk with that, and 6.8 Western. Yep.
Yeah.
Flat shooting, knocks them down, and if I can get past the nerves and when hopefully everything kind of unfolds and make the right shot, which so I'll say a prayer right now. Dear Jesus, let this happen. But so it's the 6.8 Western.
That can't go wrong there, man. I know Austin Manelik, you know, we had him on a couple weeks ago. He's in the same boat. He loves the 6.8. He's an Alaskan guide, and he swears by it.
Did he hold up this box right there?
He did. He held up that box, but his box looked like it was in his pocket for about 5 years. It was basically cloth. It was in his pack so long.
Does he shoot a lot less than me? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't know. I'm
carrying around newer boxes.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a nice box. But yeah, I mean, we've talked through the 6.8 is just such an incredible development in technology that Browning and Winchester kind of it was a cooperative effort. And when that cartridge was released, we shot a bunch of stuff with it in the fall. I'm not kidding you, man. I took it on a whitetail hunt in Kansas. I'd never seen that type of impact on a whitetail deer for basically something that is, it's like shooting a 30-30, basically, you know, from a recoil perspective. I mean, it knocked them down.
That goat right there,
with
the crazy horn, it has a horn that sticks down. That, which 6.8 Western might have been, that it was epic shot on that goat right there with the 6.8 Western.
Yeah.
There's no question of what happened when that went down. And in moments like that, or I got the biggest deer in my life sitting right here staring at me, is about a 190 inch whitetail. Same thing. It's moments like that that you want to be shooting that, because that makes sure that goes down.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm not chasing anything. It's like, boom, shot made, deer down, goat down. There's the elk right there that I shot with it. Same thing down. And, at that point it's celebration time.
Yeah. And you're shooting Expedition Big Game, right? As far as
the 165s. I'm going to shoot the Extreme Weather Model 70.
Yes.
I had a muzzle brake one though, but I might have put a suppressor on it. So
yeah. What's your comfortable range?
About 8 miles.
That's not bad. Curvature of the earth.
We just listen. Yep, got him. I'm not a long distance guy. It's fun to shoot at the gongs out there or whatever and hear that when you're just dinking around, but I 300 is about as far as I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable beyond that.
Yep.
400 or 500, I'm still comfortable at it. I don't choose that.
Right.
And I don't want that. if we're mountain goat hunting and the guy that I'm hunting with says, you know, Ben, you know, we're sitting at 400, I'm gonna be saying like, let's try to climb a little closer to that thing, because I'm not into sending them that far, but I can, but I prefer a little bit closer, so I'd take it.
So if you were thinking back over the course of, I mean, you've been with Winchester almost two decades, is that one of the products that they've kind of come out with, innovation wise, that you've been super blown away with, or is there others?
Well, that I have taken full advantage of. This is the number one. You know, the 350 Legend. You know, when they launched that, you know, that's not. I live on the prairie.
Yeah,
it's wide open spaces, and you know our shots do range out there a little bit. You know, I don't prefer them, but we do take those shots. So you know the other innovations that came out, I definitely was a part of, and I mean I loved being a part of it. I mean anytime I get to ask to be part of that is amazing.
Yeah.
But when the 6.8 Western was launched, that was like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna have fun with this thing. And actually, it is a fact, and it is true. And you can ask the folks at Winchester. I am the first person ever to shoot a coyote with that round.
Really?
Oh yeah, that's and they better admit that, because that's documented. So the first coyote kill with the old 6.8 is this guy.
Yeah, old Benny.
Right, yeah, that's pretty special.
Well,
but was not 8 miles. That was probably about 30 yards.
Okay. Oh boy. Well, I think, you know, when you
6.8 won, coyote 0.
Yeah, the coyote did not win that one.
No.
Yeah, I think when it comes to products, I think that's just like that across the country, is you use the innovation that fits where you're from. And you live in a big open country. Obviously, 6.8 makes sense for us. 350 Legend, 400 Legend, but 350 in particular, we're in big woods. We hunt a lot of places that you can't use rifle. You can use shotgun or muzzleloader. That 350 with the straight wall completely changed the game for all of us, for my kids.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of what Winchester does, I think. I think they look at what's the hole. And we were on some of those calls very early on the creative for the 350 Legend and the storytelling and how we're going to kind of apply that in the marketing plan. But they have products that fit everybody from every part of the country.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And when they come out with standby, that guy right there.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
That's when a guy like this is in heaven.
Yeah.
Heaven.
So over the years, I mean, being part of Winchester, just to kind of wrap this up, it's one of those things where I think we came along about the same time with Winchester. We started working with them, I think, in 08, 09, right around in there. We're still here. And you said this earlier, it is like family. A lot of the faces that have been with Winchester since we started working with them back in you know, 15 years ago, it's still the same people. And that actually means something in this industry. And sometimes it's not like that. What's it like to work with a company like Winchester?
So my first duck, my first goose was a Winchester Ranger 20 gauge.
Yeah.
That's what that was. My first deer was a Model 70. My first deer with my gun was a Model 70, but my first deer was a Super Grade 243 of my dad's.
Yeah.
So I've been a Winchester guy forever. Mm-hmm. And to be able to work with them is the absolute dream come true. Absolute dream come true. Gilbertson knows that, and Rafe and Shondi, they know that. I mean, it's a dream come true. The best people on the planet, the best company on the planet, the best products on the planet, and they're my first. They're 2009.
Yeah.
2009. Jason came on board, and the fact that they still want to work with me, is very special.
Yeah, man.
Very special.
Well, it says something says something for you too, though, man. I mean, it's you obviously, there's a lot of respect still in the industry for what you've done and what you did. And, you know, I think there's still a little corner of the world that's wondering if you'll ever get back into it. But, you know, I think that in the end, it doesn't really matter. You made your mark and you have a family now that you're making memories with. And, you know, that's really what it's all about in the end anyway.
Well, you got to come out here and enjoy some South Dakota pheasant hunting with me is what you have to do.
Yes, I would absolutely love that. And I know, I don't know if the schedule is going to line up, but this fall, again, I said this earlier, we're going to come out and we're going to shoot a great Winchester Life episode with you, kind of relive a little bit of the glory days, but also to jump out and shoot some pheasants and be part of your world there for a few days. So I'm looking forward to that, getting that into the editing bay and telling a great story. But brother, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit down with us and tell us your story, man.
I thank you so much for asking me to do this. This has been a lot of fun and reliving all this and going over the fun memories. I really appreciate that. And to everybody at Winchester, you know, I love you guys and thank you for all the years. And hopefully we can do a lot more of it too, because there's a lot yet still to come, if you know what I mean.
Great, man. Thanks, Benny.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please make sure you click the follow button on your podcast apps so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Aaron Cox and Jason Gilbertson, engineered by Jason Freer, directed by Chad Andrus, written and edited by Jason Brown, with behind-the-scenes photography by Kelsey Myers. I'm Jason Brown, and you've been listening to the Winchester Life Podcast. See you next time.